the reason there's a rubber band around this thing is that otherwise the battery dies out. All right, before we started on the Maroons, which are our first subject for today, I had some general comments coming out of having read drafts from lots of people of their papers, and hopefully comments that are of some use in the revision of the papers. One of them is that you do have to remember that the subject of this course is legal system is very different from ours. So if you're writing about some modern private law system that's embedded in the general U.S. or EU or something legal system, obviously you have to say something about the system it's embedded in. But the interesting parts of your article you're really focusing on are supposed to be not modern U.S. law or modern EU law, but whatever legal system you're looking at that's actually not a standard modern law. Now, obviously, that's not much of a problem if you're looking at, the Hammurabi's code or something of that sort. But a number of you are doing things where what you're looking at is in some sense part of a modern society, and I just think, not that you can't mention obviously the surrounding legal code, but that you want the substance, what I'm really evaluating on, what I learn about a different system or what the reader learns. The other point, and this is a much more general than this course or this paper, is that you want to think about how people know things. So that, and that's true both about your own reading and to some extent about how you write the article. So if you tell me in legal system X such and such was true, I want to know, is this a report on a primary source account of the legal system, for example, the surviving law code? Is it what some secondary source tells you is true? If the latter, how does he know? So it would seem to me that one of the things that shouldn't be a very large part of your paper, but that ought to be in probably almost all of these papers, is some brief discussion of sources. And sources should never be limited to Harvard professor so-and-so who studied this thing. Because I want to know how does Harvard professor so-and-so form his opinions about it. And if the real answer is he's making it up, which it is if he doesn't have any sources, so to speak. I hope that by this time you people have lived long enough in the world to realize that the fact that something is in a printed book doesn't mean it's true. All right? Especially since you're law students, you have surely noticed that highly respectable law professors can write things which other highly respectable law professors think are nonsense. All right? If you've been watching the controversy over the mandate, it's clear that you've got a case where some, able, intelligent, respectable people say there is a strong constitutional case against the mandate. And others say it is absurd to think that there is a strong constitutional case against the mandate. It's obviously constitutional. And that's fine. I mean, just as long as you realize that that's the world you're living in and that, therefore, really nothing is to be taken as gospel. I had a discussion when we were talking about the Icelandic stuff about sources. I don't remember how much of it is in the chapter, but we talked about it, at least in class. And one of the really crucial issues to which we don't know the answer is when the sagas were composed. All right? If the sagas are a oral literature composed in the late 10th and early 11th century, then their authors were intimately familiar with late 10th and early century institutions, and presumably the picture in the sagas is at least a reasonably accurate picture, allowing for distortions due to making a good story and such. If the sagas were composed by the people who wrote them down in the late 13th and early 14th century, and they were using bits and pieces of oral tradition about the past, but were really largely modeling it on what they saw around them in the period of breakdown of the system, then we can't rely on them as an account on the early period. And I discussed some reasons for believing one or the other, but my point is just that this is an issue that almost, I suspect all of you are going to be facing in some sense or other. One of the papers is in fact on Hammurabi's code and that legal system. And I looked at this some years ago for this course. I don't know if any of you noticed, but the top page of the site for this course has a picture of Hammurabi's code. It's a black stone in the Louvre Museum in Paris. Click on that picture and you get the links. All right, that picture is in fact a hidden link to stuff that I dug up like 4 years ago or something when I was doing. What really struck me was when I read two different translations of Hammurabi's code, and they aren't the same code, right? One of them I think was a 19th century one, and more recent. I don't know to what extent we've improved, but it was clear, this is a language that's been dead for thousands of years. On the other hand, there is not just the code. There's a bunch of clay tablets, as I understand, a very large amount of literature, as it were, in terms of very short records that survive because clay lasts better than paper does. So one could try to reconstruct the language, and people obviously have tried to reconstruct the language, and I expect it has some connections to some surviving languages. But nonetheless, you want some feel for how solid the information you're going on is, before you just even trust a primary source, given that you don't read the language in most of these cases, and even more when you're trusting a secondary source. So a general rule, anytime anybody tells you anything, before you ask the question, is it true, you ask the question, how can he know? Because if he's telling you something that he cannot know, there's no reason to believe it, and you shouldn't trust him. Of course, it might be that you can't see how he can know, but when you ask him, it turns out, yes, indeed, he has a perfectly good basis for it, and hopefully if you're reading a book, the author will explain those things. But anyway, it just seemed to me that those were a bunch of things that it was worth people thinking about with regard to both their primary and secondary sources. I assume people are familiar with the distinction. The primary, strictly speaking, a translation of Hammurabi's code is a secondary source to the translation, but mostly people don't make that distinction. But a book by a modern scholar about Hammurabi's code is a secondary source. And he surely knows more about it than you do, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's right. And one of the reasons you read multiple books is their authors sometimes disagree. And one of the reasons you read the book and then look at the translations of the code is to say, is this really what that passage said? Is it ambiguous in one way or another? And so forth. So those seem to me that sort of thinking about your sources was important. And one problem that I think a number of the papers had, possibly because they were first drafts, is that they felt to me too much like data dumps rather than essays. That is to say, obviously one of the ways of doing a paper like this is you start out by finding everything you can about the subject, copy and paste, which is a whole lot easier than it used to be when you had to type stuff in yourself. But then, having done that, you're then supposed to say, all right, we now know that the way this legal system worked, or we now believe, or my best guess is, or here are some interesting questions, but something where you've taken all that information and sort of combined it in your head, and you are now telling your reader what you have, what beliefs you have formed about the system on the basis of the source. So that nothing wrong with quoting people occasionally. I think it's arguable that law cases quote much too much. That I can't remember who it was, but some law professor I think I knew said that he was planning at some point to try to write a law review article that consisted entirely of quotations with no original text at all, to see if he could do it. Just as there is a professor I know who wrote a poem in which the last line of every verse is a footnote, which I thought was rather cute. I think that was Richard Craswell, who's now at Stanford. He was in Chicago then. Sort of interesting guy. Those are just sort of general issues of what you ought to be thinking about. I assume you've got a wide range of background, and you know, some of you may have an undergraduate degree in history or anthropology and be used to trying to tease out this stuff, and some of you have an undergraduate degree in mathematics. You know, everything that matters you're supposed to be able to check for yourself, not depend on believing that the Euler said it or something. But these are issues that you have to think about in this kind of thing. So before we go on to talking about the Maroons, who are a weird and interesting society, any questions, comments, discussions? Yes. Yes, generally I've already, I think, emailed. What I've generally done is I take your paper and I go through it and I make notes in red and I mark anything that looks to me like a typo in red. There are an awful lot of typos in some of those papers, but again, it's supposed to be a draft, not a published version. And occasionally, if there's something where it looks to me like there's a word missing because the sentence doesn't make any sense, I'll take the two words that's got the one in between and put them red. So those are just sort of ways of trying to make it a little easier for you to edit your papers. But yes, I haven't done all of them, but I think at this point, I think over half of them I have sent back attachments with my comments on them. And you're welcome to send me more drafts, I mean, you know, in between, if you like. Yep. Yeah, I'll be available today for my office hours, I'm sure. At some point, I need to get about 15 minutes to get ready for my other class, but I shouldn't do it. All right, so I will now yield the floor, and then we have a paper about the Maroons.
I brought a book as well.
Right.
If you want to look at it, it's more than pictures. It doesn't have any pictures. It's not that interesting at all. It's actually a treatise on maroons, and it's kind of a compilation by an anthropologist of all sorts of sources from the variety of maroons that exist in the big world.
Does he like the maroons?
Yeah, he very much does like the maroons, and I think that's one of the problems with it. But he does a good job of, at least for my section, I purchased the book and I found out that the articles in it I had already found elsewhere in my online.
Yeah.
But it was interesting for the contrasts, and he does a good,
yeah,
has a good chapter on the similarities and the characteristics of maroons throughout. Generally, the New World, I say the New World because there are maroons in anywhere there was slavery, but typically, when you say maroons, you're referring to people in the Caribbean.
So you're defining maroons as communities of escaped slaves.
Yeah, well, the concept is essentially just people running away from slavery. And you kind of think
only sub-Saharan Africans running away from slavery?
Anybody that's enslaved. I mean, the word would encompass anyone that's enslaved. And I think because of the clash between cultures, where you have Western European civilization, and then you're bringing people from all over Africa, and the environments, you know, the really harsh environments in the New World, that's kind of a unique concept.
It sounded from your paper as though the African culture fed into it.
It is.
Slavery, after all, has existed in,
yeah,
you know, in China, it existed in...
So, the running theme through all of those, you know, depending on the different countries, there's maroons in Guatemala, there's anywhere there's slavery. All throughout the Caribbean, even down in Brazil, there's communities as well.
How about in the time of the Roman Empire? Were there communities of escaped slaves, do we know?
There may have been, but they don't use that term to... I don't think that term maroons is...
So you're really thinking of it as African escaped slaves.
It is really African. Well, it's the connotation that's typically used.
New World African?
New World.
We don't have examples of escaped slaves
not
in the Middle East.
Not any that I've found or not really.
You might want to look at, there was a big slave revolt in the Middle East. I will remember in a minute the term that's used for it, but it was like it went for years and years where you'd had a whole lot of African, again, slaves who were, I think, agricultural laborers and for a while established sort of...
That community might be fundamentally different because the legal system in which they're embedded is different.
Yes.
So there's kind of a common theme for, even in Jamaica, which is English common law, the Spanish were there first, so there's traces of civil law elements in their, mm-hmm, in their culture. And it's really, I first experienced them as I visited a village. They're also known as Grifina or Cimarrones, or there's a variety of names, Quilombos in Brazil. And I visited a village with my family as a child, and I was just fascinated. It was, not, you know, on the outer end of Guatemala, and entirely different. You know, they operate just different from the rest of Guatemala, but they're very open to tourism.
Yeah.
And that brings another problem with a lot of rules, is that they're not considered indigenous peoples, so there's no protection of their cultural rights. There's no... Right now there's an issue with intellectual property because now they're really open to tourism and letting people come in, and they come and see these traditional dances and ceremonies that they have, but there's no way of protecting them. They're kind of subsumed in the broader Jamaican state. They say this is part of our culture, and so they really can't protect that in a lot of ways.
Well, you... Yes, sir.
So it seemed to me one of the most interesting things about the society was that it looked like, to summarize, is that this is a society in which the main legal system is about culture, defined by communication with ghosts. And the obvious question to raise, or raises in my mind, is what do the ghosts say? Is there any consistency to it? Or is this really just a way, from an anthropological perspective, for the leadership to gain increased authority by simply making a claim to the spirit world for their decisions?
It is, and that's what brought the change to Christianity in about the 1930s. One of the tie-ins to African culture is that there's this idea that your leader, your chieftain, has kind of all-powerful, but it kind of does it in a beneficial way, like allocates land. And you have this communication system where when they sign a treaty, not only did it bind them, but it bound all maroons, all the people that lived in that area, and then everyone in the future was bound by it. So there's this kind of... They have this communicative discourse when they solve problems internally, where they go back and talk to their ancestors, because that kind of keeps them in check. They don't want to expand too much and lose their identity. And this idea of communicating with the people who signed the treaty in the first place.
But don't we do that too?
We do. That's originalism, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we have that system.
We believe the Constitution binds future generations that never signed it.
Yeah, we still literally think Thomas Jefferson is walking around the Capitol saying, no, that's not all right.
Yeah, but
some people do, but...
But we have written literature as an alternative, right?
Yeah, yeah. We have, and these people don't write anything down. One of the groups said that when you talk to the Maroons, the idea that I got from the anthropologists, they're highly unreliable because they paint everything in their own perspective of this is what happened.
But they've really been out of touch. It wasn't really until the turn of the century where they had to start relying on Jamaica in general. And a lot of it had to do with food shortages. Originally, when they signed their treaty, the government said, okay, you can't do sugar. You can't do sugar. You cannot grow sugar. You can't have an economy. Because they wanted to have that, they wanted to make them reliant as slave trackers. The whole purpose of the British signing a treaty with them was to kind of quell these revolts, which they really, you know, guerrilla revolts are, you know, it's, they jump, they come out, they kill a bunch of planters, and then run back into the woods, and they wanted really to quash that, but at the same time, stop their expansion. So they said, look, you guys are free, you can do what you want with limited autonomy, which they, but you have to run around and track slaves.
Have to, or that's the job we will offer you, and we will try to make it.
They have to, and then like years later, they pass a law saying, "All right, well, you guys are slave trackers, but we're going to put a white officer above you guys to keep you in order. He'll do it."
When you say they have to, it isn't clear to me whether what you're saying is that the rules were designed to eliminate alternatives so they would choose to, or whether they were actually agreeing in the treaty from the English standpoint.
They were agreeing to track slaves. Their economy at the time, and they're allowed to do like hunt boar and stuff, and they could do minor trading. But for the most part, that's, you have to understand that Maroon Trinity is mainly men. That they have a high ratio of men because it's people that basically have been fighting on the plantation and escaping. And so one of their big things was going down and trying to find women. And that was another point of convergence between the two communities before the treaties, was how they protected women. Because I thought this was interesting, but it didn't really have a place in the paper, and that one community was really open to polygamous marriages. Not polygamy, I wouldn't say polygamy per se, but you could have, if your wife slept with another guy in the community, you would have to come to an arrangement where you'd say, all right, she's my wife 2 days out of the week, she's your wife 5 days.
That's polyandry.
Polyandry. But all the kids are mine, so if my wife has kids with someone else, those are technically my kids, and I'm going to take care of them. Uh-huh. And it was a way of increasing their numbers. But on the other community, which is a little bit, the one that I did write about, the Windwards. I always get the terminology confused. The Windwards, who were a lot more, actually they were more ethnically diverse because they had been more Spanish-speaking Maroons who joined that community. That was the foundation of that community. Their system was that if you did, there was a guard over their women day and night. So the women would sleep, and there was somebody whose challenge was to guard and make sure that nobody else was doing anything behind someone's husband's back. And if they did, they would kill them. Because it was a transgression on their right. This is my wife, you know, this is how I'm going to pick. So it was interesting to see the two ways they dealt with those problems. And that was another key of a lot of the papers I read.
Might even be worth including that in the paper. It's sort of interesting.
Yeah, it goes into the broader idea of their dependency and their interaction with the British state. And another part of that was, that I don't think I may have added or gone into detail on the paper, is that the Leeward Maroons were found around this guy, Cujo, or there's various different spellings of it. And he was a military leader. They're all very strong military leaders, so he kept tight control. It was mostly mainly people from a similar part. You know, they generally spoke a similar language. They didn't have the diversity of the other group of Maroons. And the problem with the other group of Maroons as well was that their most powerful political feature was an Obeya woman named Nanny. And she was kind of this religion. I hesitate to use religion, but she was a powerful figure for them in a very similar way that Kojo was for the other Maroons, but she was more of a spiritual leader, he was a military leader, and when the British signed the treaties, they only empowered the military leaders. And so this left kind of a power struggle within the Windward Maroons, and so they couldn't keep their people in check. Some Maroons would go down and raid camps, and so they were kind of on and off interactions with the British Maroons, or the British, and kind of pushed. There wasn't stability, so it was hard for them to develop a sufficient legal structure to protect against the colonial state, and they really just were, like most Maroons in Suriname, for example, which has a very big community, they were just kind of swallowed up. You know, you have this Creole culture, and they say, oh, this is all Jamaicans, they're all Surinamese people, they're just like us, and they tried to sell their lands. And the Maroons of Acampong were the best at protecting their territorial rights, because that was the foundation, that's all they had. And they're actually starting to sell it off a lot because they need money. And so they've actually sold off part of the land to build cell towers, and I guess they make some tax money off that because they need to fill their coffers because they really don't have an economy. And yeah, times are changing. It seems like it's a pretty rough time because a lot of people are leaving their communities, so they have a tough time defining who really is a Maroon and who isn't. And everything's up in the air right now.
One of the things that wasn't clear to me reading the paper was how property actually worked. That is, the property nominally is communal. but it sounds as though it was worked privately.
Yeah.
So does that... I couldn't tell if what you were describing was a private property system in which all that the colonel was settling were disputes where I claim this has been my family's property for 100 years and you say, no, it's really ours, or whether the colonel was really allocating land in the sense of saying, look, you can work it better, you take this, and so forth.
Yeah.
Do we know?
They have kind of communal land, and you can farm on it, and they have this system of, it was kind of your family's land to use, as long as used for the purposes that were understandable to the community, and there was a system of labor where you would come and work on someone else's communal land in the morning, they would provide you with food, and then the person would return the favor. And they had various forms of, there's another paper on it, day labor, night labor, and it was how they kind of...
But the land itself was treated as private property de facto, but not de jure, or...
Yeah, it was kind of de facto private property in that you could, if you had been using it for a while, you could continue using it.
Could your kids use it?
Your kids could use it. The only real but where the problems would come up was that everything's kinship-based in the community, so if you were using it and someone else wanted to use your land, if they complained to the colonel that it was related to them, then there might be some, you know, risk or kind of sneakiness going around the back, and they'd say, oh, in past times, you know, this land needed to be used for this. We're going to allocate it to these people instead. And it would cause the Maroons to get frustrated and say, we don't trust our authorities, and go to the Jamaican court. And the Jamaican court would say, all right, this is your land, they'll individualize it. You know, and so that they could pin these people into the tax net, and then they lose their power. They're just another Jamaican citizen. And they do have the most individual land they have is their, basically they have houses. Obviously, those are individualized. And now with the effort to kind of increase tourism, you want to get money to build up your house, to build a little hotel, well, that's individual land, and so that causes another problem. So they kind of have this way where it's kind of like your yard and your house is your territory to do what you want. You can plant your own stuff in there. But they had plenty of land out. I mean, land problems weren't really big until you had all these other, I think it's the bauxite, mining came in, and all these other industries came into Jamaica and just kind of surrounded them. Because they were really, really remote. The key thing about Maroons is that they just had to be in a place where the colonists couldn't come get them, and it let them be isolated and insular for a long period of time. And then when people showed up, they didn't really know how to interact with them.
So does that mean that that land was essentially a free good in the early period?
Yeah, it very much was. And they actually, their land claim was for 1,500 acres. And they actually didn't sign it. The Akonkwan Maroons didn't sign it. The Treelawney Maroons signed it. And the Akonkwan Maroons just kind of took over that treaty when they deported the Treelawney Maroons to Nova Scotia. After, you know, there was a little bit of a fight between them, the British were like, it'll be fine, and they sent them off to Canada and back to Africa, and the Akonkwan Maroons just kind of took over their claim to the treaty, but didn't actually get in their lands. And originally it said 1,500 acres, and before that it had been 15,000 acres, but a zero just kind of disappeared off the treaty, and none of the Maroons were literate. So, you know, he marked with an X, and then they kind of went on and proceeded. So it's a very, very wishy-washy how far out they own, because if you can define how far out they own, then you can limit them to this reservation, and they're going to say, oh no, historically we've been beyond this and you're encroaching on our lands. But it's become less of a problem because people, now that you can just leave and go to Jamaica or, you know, Kingston and get a job, people are like, I don't want to stay around here farming if I can make more money.
And do you know if farmland in fact is valuable in that area or not?
Not really. I mean, they really stopped them. They're really gearing up towards. They got like a telephone recently in the village, and they're really kind of like the Austrian government gave them a computer, and so now they have a little tourist area. And they're trying to get people in. I saw an article in Daily Mail or something about come to this place where there's no crime. They haven't had any crime in 250 years. Like, the one crime they had was a foreigner that came in and stole something. But any crime that they had would have been resolved on a local level. They wouldn't even communicate that to the outside world.
Yep.
So.
So back to your presentation. We'll stop interrupting you for 5 minutes.
No, it's fine. If you have any questions, go ahead. Yeah.
I mean, this isn't really a legal argument, but from my perspective, a very interesting version of your paper would be about compare and contrast the two Maroon communities in Jamaica, the Libre versus the Lone Survive, and talk and explain. I mean, that's my personal bent. But look at why these particular things changed in the way they did, and why one survived and the other one didn't. Of political structure and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think they were basically, one was up in the mountains, the Windwards were up in the mountains, they ran up in the mountains, and in between, the land in between was just settled by the British colonists, all came to the land in between to kind of cut them off. And I just think they were closer in contact, but they started interacting, and eventually one of their colonels, they kind of had a similar system, one of their colonels became an elected official. then it was a local representative, and they just kind of turned it into a political post, and now these people are in the tax. They claim to be Maroons, but they don't have any special benefits of it. They don't have their land, they don't have their communal system, and they just live in a town that looks like any other town in Jamaica, like kind of rural town in Jamaica, and they only have these different traditions, but it's kind of more of something.
Well, it survived in a sense then, but just didn't survive as a cultural entity.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't satisfy as any type of entity either. They're there, and there's other people living amongst them. They moved, and they kind of, because they don't have that close border idea, they moved all over the place. But I think you're right, that they're a good contrast to kind of give. But at that point, it's like there's so many different root communities, and then you start to see the different interactions of the colonial state.
But one of the issues that we've discussed earlier is how embedded systems can survive, as it were. And so it might be interesting, depending on how much data you have,
to see in
which ones succeeded in maintaining an embedded legal system and in which ones it eventually dissolved.
Yeah, the answer given by one of the anthropologists is the internal power structures, and that there was no power given officially to their obeya, so there was no tradition of military control.
But why did who the British gave power to matter?
Yeah.
Because I think it mattered into the Maroons. I don't think it mattered so much to the. I think it kind of undermined. Their society is a really military organized. Like, there was a point where, even though they signed a treaty with the British that said, you have to send all your. Anybody kill someone, you get sent to us. The British actually pardoned a group of them, and Kodjo went and killed them. Said, no, you screwed around with the British. Killed them, and the other group didn't really have that. There was no power because there was a disconnect, I think, between the obeya and whoever was in control, and so there was nobody to really say, we can kill these people and stay in line, and then it just kind of fell apart. But I think you need to look into that a bit more.
When we were talking about the Amish, we were talking about whether embedded legal systems survive by cooperating or by resisting the superordinate legal system. It'd be interesting to apply that question to your group.
Yeah, I don't know how much cooperation there is. I mean, now there's a lot of. It's funny because they wrote a constitution, right? Right before Jamaican independence, the Maroons wrote themselves a constitution, and that was the last they used it. It was basically like a move to show, the post-independence state, oh, we've been here, we had a constitution before you did, just to kind of maintain their interaction with them. And I think a lot of power was lost. Originally, they put a superintendent in to control the Maroons. And the British saw this as a superintendent is going to make sure these people are in check. And the Maroons saw it as, this is our ambassador to the outside world. And so after emancipation, when they didn't need, not independence, after emancipation, when the Maroons were given the same status as all other blacks in Jamaica, they removed the liaison, and the Maroons were like, now we have nobody to communicate our desires to the outside world. And they kind of walled off. And the real change was when missionaries came. When missionaries came at first, and people were totally not receptive to it, and they kind of gave up. First, I think it was Anglican missionaries, and then the Church of Scotland came back, and it kind of coincided with the time that the economy was going into crisis, and this guy, Colonel Cawley, used his power, he was a devout Christian, and was like, no, Christianity is the way to go. Our economic problems are caused by these spiritual, spiritual practitioners who are manipulating our ancestors into doing what they want. And he did this whole thing that I wrote about burning down the hut, and it kind of caused this change where they were then able to ban these practices for a while and really establish Christianity as the dominant religion. I think it still is the dominant religion, but it's kind of this hybridized thing where you have Christianity up here, but it still has this pantheon of.
I'm not sure it would fit in your paper, but it would seem as though the comparison with voodoo would be interesting, because that's another hybrid of European and African.
Yeah, there's a lot of relation. There's a lot of notes in the reading about how similar it is to Santeria.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know that much about those practices. I imagine there's a lot of similarities in the hybridization of African spiritual practices with kind of your new environment and then the legal system above it.
It'd be interesting to take, going back to embedded legal systems, it'd be interesting to take a prospective look. You said that modern culture is more and more encroaching on the boundaries of Maroon legal society. And as other governments does become kind of closer and more inevitable, how will Maroon society best survive, either by cooperation or by resistance?
I actually believe by cooperation, because there's some need. I mean, they need to be a part of this. They need the money from schools. They need tax dollars from there's a need for that because they can't until they can build their economy on their own within. And I think, but I think before that happens, someone needs to recognize that they're distinct people, so they can protect a lot of their institutions. And you know, can say because people are coming in and videotaping their performances and then going off, and they have no rights to say, you know, this is our tradition.
That doesn't hurt them. That doesn't hurt them. Destroy or in any way, influence their internal society.
Well, it influences the fact that they can't make any revenue off of it.
They weren't making revenue beforehand. Nothing has changed.
But they can make revenue by charging for performances. They can make revenue off tourists, right?
Yeah, but to make revenue off tourists, they're going to need a bunch of cash. They need money to come in to build up the infrastructure. Like, the place has like one of the things that, you know, it had one computer. They just had one cell phone tower. So I don't know how prevalent people are have the internet, but they need money to build this stuff because they just don't have that capital. And one place that might change is that as they started to become more and more in contact with the outer Jamaican state, the position of the colonel became more politicized, and there became benefits to it. So being part of the council, you were now given money to travel, and they go and they're trying to set up a Maroon Federation, you know, of all Maroons. But the problem with that is that the Jamaican Maroons, they're special, they don't speak the same language as a certain amount of these Maroons. They don't have any money to travel, so it's just kind of semantics. But the whole relationship now, so the colonel has been, many, many times in the recent years, the colonel has been a police officer from Kingston. So their Maroons had just left, got other jobs, and saw this power vacancy and said, I'm a Maroon, I'm coming back. And I think that they, you know, that kind of ties into the military. They actually forced them to change. The name's Colonel and everything came from British military order originally. And so there's a still conception that they're the military commanders. So it's nice to have a police officer come back in because they can impose order. But a lot of times they're outsiders, you know, and in fact they're working for the Jamaican state. So they have different, just coming back to the perks and being able to say they're a part of the system. And there's no real control. There's nothing, no constitution to say who is a Maroon.
What happened when slavery ended and therefore the job of slave hunter vanished?
They started farming, and then they were able, that's when the whole, the complex over communal land, I mean, they didn't develop at that point because that was still in the 1840s and they were still relatively isolated from the rest of the community. But they put them from being a special subject class above the slaves to just being on par with them. And they didn't really see that change. They still thought of themselves as special and independent people. And when actually the queen came, they began to the queen have an audience with the Maroons who were totally offended when she didn't come. Because they felt those, the Jamaican state and it's us, you know, those are the two entities that are here. The money problems are really what's kind of getting to them right now. I mean, they come kind of, it's a small sort of place. They didn't have a market, so they had to interact to some extent if you wanted to go sell things.
But they presumably can have a market now, right?
No, they don't have.
What does that mean? You can't have a grocery store?
No, I don't know what it means if I don't have a market. I mean, a place to go sell and trade. I would think that when they meant market, they meant one of those traditional, you know, here in South America, you can go to a market and buy food.
But what prevents them from having that now?
I don't think they. I think they probably can go outside the community and buy the thing that they need, or can take other stuff. Or they have enough family members outside that send them.
But they, in fact, can't have a market in where they are now.
Yeah, they can. They just haven't. Yeah. They haven't built one because they didn't really have the infrastructure for. You know, there's no industry. They're not really building anything to sell. They don't really have any like trinkets or things that they can sell. You know, you've got a lot of ethnic communities, and they're like,
but,
well, like a bobblehead.
But that's only for the tourists. Presumably the normal market, I assume, in a Caribbean village is people selling stuff to each other.
Yeah, I imagine they probably have stores and stuff to provide basic goods, and I don't know how that gets into the community. That'd be good to figure out as well.
Well, do they have a sufficient population to support a market like that?
Not really. They have about, the numbers range anywhere from 500 to 1,500, but you don't really, nobody knows. So you can only kind of gauge on the people around there that are related to you. And they have polling stations all throughout Jamaica. There's 9 of them. And so they don't have any really way to know if you're not a Maroon going and voting in their elections. Presumably most of Jamaicans don't care about their elections, but they really don't have that system set in place to define. So even if you could define these are our rights as Maroons, who would you give them to? You'd have to come up with a system, and there's too much bickering. And that would have to be done by the...
But that's an issue for American Indians too, because some of them, in some cases, tribes have various legal rights or income, and then the question is who is or isn't a member of the tribe.
Yeah, and they're not that organized. There's I don't think there's enough of them. They have elections now. You know, it was an interesting point that they made that when they freed all the rest of the Jamaicans it was a democracy, and the Maroons had to wait till the 50s for there to be a democracy because they still have this kind of tenure system where. You have your colonel and then you kind of appoint just gets handed off. And there was a power struggle in the 50s among different families that wanted to be the colonel. And they actually had to go out to the Jamaican government and be like, please tell us who is the colonel. And the Jamaican government said, we have elections now. These are the only people that are going to be elected. And now they actually control and ask that, you know, the Jamaican government rules over their elections. I think the Maroons can vote in Jamaican elections, and so they just take that voter registration list and say these are the people that are technically called Maroons and just come in and vote off that. So they're kind of, you know, there's definitely enough links to the outside Jamaican state, but I don't...
But legally speaking, they're ordinary Jamaican citizens.
Yeah, they are. They're just ordinary Jamaican citizens, because when Jamaica became independent, they just said absolutely nothing about the Maroons. And that's another issue in international law, is whether the laws in effect before there was independence remain, and the post-independent state has to acknowledge it to some respect. And they have kind of implicitly by interfering with their affairs, but they haven't gone out and said, these are distinct people with distinct rights, and so there's an issue for them there. But they are still relatively independent. The largest state is Suriname, and Suriname is a different country in general than Jamaica, in that it's way more ethnically diverse. You have Jews, you have, you know, people from Hindus, you have all sorts of people there, so they kind of understand, it's more of a Creole culture in that we just merged everything together, so it's a lot easier for them to swallow up the different Maroon states in there, and also because Suriname here, Guyana, French, you know, all the different, this drew those lines, so it cut off some of the communities in general, so there's a lot more.
Are there any reasonably coherent Maroon communities that are coastal and therefore could try to claim the right to trade with the rest of the world independent of the surrounding government?
The Maroon community I went to in Guatemala, or Griffin, a community, is called Livingston, and it's out on the water. You know, they could in theory be, you know, if they walled it off, it would be their
own home.
It would be the connection between them and the Guatemalan state. And that part of Guatemala is really, there's nobody there. You go to a lot of, you know, the closest town is probably, I mean, you take a boat to get there. I don't think you can drive. I had to take a boat up river like 3 hours.
Yeah.
And the town I came from was 2,000 people. So they're really, you know, far enough out that they could do this, and Guatemala is kind of not really structured well enough for them to deal with it. But I don't think they really haven't had any need to, because they get enough of the tourists coming in.
I have a friend who's Canadian First Nations and who was pushing an idea at one point to get her tribe, which is in British Columbia, to essentially claim that the rights it had under treaty allowed it to be a free trade area, thus a sort of a North American Hong Kong. And I don't know if it ever got anywhere, but it was an interesting idea, and I was wondering whether there were similar possibilities here.
Yeah, the treaty rights are bizarre for the Maroons. I mean, they went, you know, after signing it, the English were like, we're just going to repeal these, you know, unilaterally repeal that treaty, and it had no effect on the Maroons. And while the British did it, they still treated them like they were operating under the term of the treaty, so there were all these kind of bad faith efforts to eradicate the deal they made, but they really didn't follow through with it. And my idea is that they weren't able to do it from a legal perspective, but through other cultural aspects, reliance, religion, and even the economy, they find a way to creep back within Maroon society, and that kind of understanding that there's nothing so unique about you guys anymore, don't you want to become a part of the Jamaican system? They do recognize the Maroons as part of the, as kind of unique in Jamaica. They claim that, you know, we have Maroons. But that's Jamaica, you know, that's not really the Maroons saying that. So they're willing to acknowledge that these people are special, but they're not willing to acknowledge to the people that they're special.
It'd be interesting if you could focus more on sort of the internal workings, the sense in which it's its own legal system. And it's hard to know how much you can tell about that. There's an awful lot of your paper really is about the interaction with the British, and that's obviously part of the framework of it. But
yeah,
it'd be nice to understand sort of, is the colonel, prior to the current elections, does the colonel appoint his successor? Or is there some kind of a consensus mechanism among the movers and shakers in the community? Do we know? Does anybody know?
They're all kinship-based. So everybody who's been colonel is related to someone, you know, someone who had been colonel before. And there's this kind of idea that if you come from a family of power, it's not divine right to rule, but it's kind of like you're just more in contact with the ancestors, you have more understanding of our system, so naturally we're going to put someone whose family was powerful, because it gives them more time.
But when we say we are going to put, what decides? If two different people both want to be colonel, what happens?
Now it's election.
Now it is, but prior to now.
Prior to, they fought. And I think that's why they ended up having elections imposed on them, because it got to the point where you're basically become colonel on symbolic capital. If enough people think in the community, before election, if enough people think in the community that you are capable to, you know enough of the old practices, you have enough respect amongst the families to kind of You know, if they think you can justly resolve all their situations, then you were an apt person to be the colonel. And then it got to the point where there was too many divisions and they thought people were biased for whatever reasons, religion or family ties. And so then nobody had enough symbolic capital to be opposed to the colonel, and that's when the state had to come in. And now, so that's the only position that's up for election is the colonel, and if you finish second, you're the deputy colonel. And below the colonel, I mean, he has all these powers to allocate land, and most of the stuff, you know, I think he has, you know, adjudicatory powers as well, but a lot of stuff is done by his ministers. So if you basically look at other people, and you can basically appoint yourself a minister of anything, minister of finance, minister of whatever, and your job, you know, your qualification is that someone in your family or knows about the history of Maroon economy or history of Maroon land rights. You know, if you have a land dispute, you would bring someone in and they would say, well, historically, this land here has been used for this, and this land here has been used for this.
But then the other party to the dispute goes to a different authority, so what determines what authority rules? Do we know?
They would leave, and then, I don't actually know. Because when they go to the outside state, the outside state only really has an opportunity to break up land that kind of extend outside of Maroon areas. And so then they then have to define what the extent of Maroon, like where your property is.
I think what you're worth, in a sense, stepping back from all the historical stuff and just saying, can I figure out how this society works?
Yeah.
Not recently, but as recently as you have data and as far back as you could push it.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff on land and the allocation of land and how they worked land. And it wasn't really, some of it's legal in a sense, but a lot of it talks about their economy.
But what if I claim the land and you claim the land? Is it just that the colonel rules, or is there?
It would be that the colonel rule. You would go, you try to solve it informally, you go to the colonel and you complain. You would say, he's on my land, and the colonel would then go over to the other person's house and try to talk it out. If he couldn't talk it out, he would go to the council, and they would bring spiritual practitioners and anybody that was old, that expert, you know, that had a good reputation for being able to solve the land. And they would come out and say, you know, back in the day, the line was here.
And who is on the council? How do you get to be on the council if they're ruling?
The colonel is to control the council, but it's basically elders in the community. Anybody that's symbolically powerful kind of claims the position in the council. And you could really add, it's not a day-to-day position. You know, some people just left. They'd be the minister of crime, and they didn't just leave. And there would be no minister of crime until somebody else is willing to step up and say, I can do it, or the colonel would do it himself.
But anyway.
Yeah, the government would range from like 5 people to like 50 people, and just really depended on the personalities of the people and the symbolic capital they could draw from the surrounding communities. So the more family you have, the more symbolic capital you would have, because your family is willing to say, yeah, they'll be colonel, and I'll be, you know, minister of transportation.
And to what extent do you end up when there are conflicts with violent conflicts, as in feuds, or?
There are no record of feuds over land.
What about nonviolent? What about the case where one group of families want him to be colonel, and one group of families want him to be colonel? Do we know? Do we have histories, as it were, of how those conflicts got settled?
I can look into it. There's definitely more information on how those got settled, but that led into the first conflict between Christianity and spiritual practitioners, and then it led into the second 1950s era.
But that's still pretty recent. It'd be nice to.
Yeah, no, there's definitely information on that. I didn't include it.
Anyway,
didn't have that in there.
All right. I think we probably want the next one now.
Yeah.
But thank you. It's clearly an interesting society, and could use 10 times the amount of time and effort you could afford to spend on it.
Well, that was the problem. Is like I found like a 150-page like PhD dissertation.
Right.
You know, some lady that lived there, and I'm like, what am I supposed to do with this? You know, I gotta
mine it.
That's
tell us about honor and being a made man, and one of us, and all this nice stuff.
The mafia. So my plan was just like give information, give kind of a general overview of my paper, and then a lot of questions kind of went up. Questions based either on the paper that was posted online, or just anything you hear me say. If by any chance you didn't get a chance to read the paper when it was posted. So the mafia was a crime syndicate, and I'll be focusing only on Sicily. There are actually 3 groups which can legitimately claim the name Mafia. Those include the Sicilian branch, the American branch, and then a different group in Calabria. But I'll only be focusing on Sicily. I called it a crime syndicate because that's what most people think of it as, but it's not clear that crime necessarily defines the mafia as such. It could be defined in other ways, and that's something that I'll be talking about. One thing that I wanted to start with is just how the mafia is structured, kind of the basic hierarchies that exist within the mafia, kind of the structures. So on the top was the boss. Most people are familiar with the notion of a crime boss. And frankly, our popular notions of a mafia boss stem from the Sicilian mafia and are somewhat correct. Below him, the boss. What he did was he essentially tended to administrative tasks.
This is the boss of what? Of Sicily? Of a city? Of one family?
Thank you. Actually, he was the boss of the family.
And there are lots of families.
There are lots of families. In Palermo alone, Palermo is one city in Sicily, although the major city. In Palermo alone, there were almost 46 families, each headed by its respective boss. And so the boss engaged in all the administrative activities. He managed the members, he made decisions, he resolved conflicts, all the things that you would think of even as a corporate boss or a corporate executive. Below him was an underboss, which is slightly analogous to the vice president. He was responsible for stepping in if the boss was captured or killed during the war or something like that. He also was in charge of secondary administrative duties, like he would talk with the soldiers if the boss is busy for some reason or otherwise occupied. Also, possibly the boss, underboss's most important function was to step in. Below the underboss was the soldiers. These are just the operative members. They carried out the crime. They were kind of your average members. They're referred to as made men. Made meaning that they were part of the group. One important position that kind of stood right up to the side of everyone was the consigliere, and he was the advisor. He was the guy who was kind of the watcher of the boss to make sure everything stayed above board. The boss held a lot of power, almost all the power to manage, and so to ensure that he didn't misappropriate money or do anything underhanded that the soldiers wouldn't approve of, the consigliere monitored him. He held no power of his own to manage, but he was kind of just a person who watched over the boss. There's also another group called the affiliati. These were mafia members that were not actually mafia members. They weren't in the mafia. They were people who affiliated with the mafia, cooperated with the mafia. These were people who worked with the mafia in particular.
Would that include a business owner who the mafia was protecting in exchange for his doing things for them?
That would not actually include him. He would be considered a client. He would be considered a member of the outside world, but not an affiliati. An affiliati would be engaged in illegal behavior. But the affiliati could include corrupt politicians, corrupt police. So that's kind of how the mafia was structured. And again, that's the structure of the family. There being multiple families, sorry about that. Again, there were 46 families in just Palermo alone, several hundred throughout Sicily. And families could range anywhere from 50 to 150 members, sometimes less. In later dates, sometimes more. I think it's important and interesting to note two different academic approaches which have approached the mafia. So there used to be three, now there's more two perspectives on the mafia. One is eminently economic, seeing the mafia as an economic group, a group of people bound together by economic ties, each member being economically rational, and they're cooperating for their mutual economic benefits, namely to make money from crime. There's a second philosophical approach, which looks at the mafia, which sees the mafia as bound by something called a pre-modern contract, or at least scholars sometimes refer to these as pre-modern contracts. Those are affiliations which are more like fraternal bonds, bonds that come anterior to economic considerations.
What's the difference between a fraternal bond and a national bond? And it's one of the things I wondered reading the paper, is there any difference between the mafia members' loyalty to the mafia and the ordinary American citizens' loyalty to America?
The fraternal bonds, the pre-modern bonds, are absolutely, positively, the primary consideration for any mafioso. Whereas a member of America places American considerations, certainly not first, somewhere down the line of priorities. And actually, a pre-modern contract would put the mafia before absolutely anything, including self. So if a mafia member faced almost certain death, but was assigned to a certain task by his boss, he would do it. Whereas most Americans probably would.
But we, in fact, approve of, and to some extent expect, not just America, but in general, in sort of the ordinary world, the idea that the brave soldier will go into machine gun fire for his... I mean, it seems to me that... Now, if you have evidence that every mafioso behaved this way, that would be a difference. But if you think about at least the ideals of ordinary nationalist societies, they do include the idea that the really good guys are willing to sacrifice their life for the good of, you know, to win the war, to whatever.
I disagree. I think in America, we approve of people doing that if they want to. Whereas in the mafia, the idea was you did it absolutely whether you wanted to or not.
That contradicts, I mean, our military. If you defy order, you go to jail. If you join the military, that's different. If I didn't die for my country, I wouldn't go to jail. But once you make a commitment and you're ordered to do something, just like a mafia boss orders you, that's a prison full of time.
True. Although I would say that the mafia bond is much more, it's personal to him. By defying the order, he's defying something that is really internal, really about his identity. He's betraying a really primary commitment. Whereas opposed to in the American military, if you defy an order, you defy something which is not as personal to you. The consequence may be similar, but the characteristic of interdict which you've violated is different.
So, as an historian, I was looking at the history of Sicily, and one of the things that was pointed out was that Sicily was conquered, it used to be Byzantine, it was conquered by the Muslims around the year 700-800. It was then conquered again by the Normans, who were literally from Normandy, came down to Sicily and took it over, freed it from the Muslims, but imposed their own rule over it. It then became part of the Kingdom of Sicily and Naples. It essentially has not had independent political existence for its entire life for the last 2,000 years. And the mafia, in this historical context, is regarded, at least by some historians, as an effort by the local people to assert some level of control against, you know, essentially foreign and somewhat rapacious tax and authority figures. So the mafia essentially is local people who have their own particular cultural, language, historical background, who see, these foreigners come in, imposing their own rules and sometimes religions on them, and they say, this is our way of fighting back, this is our way of maintaining the level of autonomy and independence, and we're going to form these very tight organizations that will, because they're working against the official state interests, they essentially have to say, have to be stronger than the ordinary bonds of legality and morality that exist around us. Hence, we have to, do these various things, murder people in order to join the organization, to prove that you're, in fact, worthy of being a part of it. So the mafia, under this historical interpretation, is very much a reaction to centuries of essentially political repression.
Yeah, to comment on that, so I should have started out by founding my discussion of whatever the best place to start. I'm only speaking between 1900 and 1950. However, what you said is relevant in that these pre-modern contracts that I'm discussing may stem from that period. May stem from the notion that communities have to be bonded. And actually to say a little bit more about that. Given that the later bound of my period is 1915, it might be fair to say that we're moving from pre-modern contracts, similar to what you described, towards a more economically oriented institution where decisions are made based on whether they're economically within the interest of the...
So in other words, both views might very well be true, that in fact it started out in one thing and over the time period you're talking about, it's moving into the other direction, which is essentially purely based on economics.
It's not a question of whether that's true. That is true after the scope of this paper. Yeah. After 1950. After 1950, that definitely didn't happen.
I always heard that the Mafia of Cosa Nostra formed in Roman times. Rome as a way of kind of allocating. You know, you have different neighborhoods and you have grain coming in was a way of kind of allocating and protecting your neighborhood interests. And that way, if you know much about the history, I know you were saying you focused on Sicily, but like, you know, obviously got to Sicily from somewhere else, right?
Yeah, actually, like, I'm just going to stay away from that entire...
could have grown up in Sicily.
Yeah, it could very well. Yeah. The Rome thing in the HBO series on Rome, you see elements of that.
That's where I actually saw it, and I actually looked past that because it's an HBO fiction. So like, I'm kind of curious about it. I've kind of talked about it as kind of a way to allocate neighborhood. You know, if you have a shortage of grain, and, you know, it comes into your community, somebody has to be there and say, no, you guys can't come in and steal all the grain. The Mafia was a way to say... okay, these people in our community will take care of this, but then, you know, you have your ties. And so that ties into what you guys were saying, if that was true, and I was just curious.
I'm just going to say, I'm staying away from that entire topic. But what I would talk about, though, is just the substantive law of the Mafia. What did these people actually think was their rule? There's no such actual division. But I think it's useful to talk about two different categories of Mafia law. One being rules which have general application, rules that govern the mafioso's life all the time. That was always true. And then second, specific rules, rules that apply only in particular situations, rules that dictated what happens or what you would do if such and such happened. The first one, rules of general application, there's actually only two of those. And those were... putting the Mafia first, so always putting the family first, even about
family or the Mafia. What about the mafiosi of another family? What are your obligations to them?
You have similar obligations to them.
So if the police are going after somebody who's a member of another family, and you can only stop them by dying, you're supposed to do so.
I'm sorry, would you repeat the question?
Police are chasing a member of another family. You can get in their way, start shooting at them, know you're going to die as a result, which you might regard as your obligation if it was one of your brothers. Do you have the same obligation if it's a member of the Mafia from a different family?
Yes. Some evidence that I would give, at least anecdotal evidence that I would give to support that view is Cosa Nostra describes all mafioso in Sicily. Cosa Nostra means our thing, meaning that everyone is a part, regardless of whichever family you happen to be in.
And yet there are very occasionally there have been conflicts in which families have been fighting each other.
Yes, and I would say that's a departure from the ideal. Something that in my paper I have to acknowledge is true. On the other hand, I would consider that illegal behavior that goes against what the law is. So getting back to those rules of general application, one I said was putting the family first, and the other was omerta. Putting the family first, like I said, just meant putting the family before anything else. One law, which I thought was interesting, that kind of fell into this category, was that you must be available for Cosa Nostra at all times, even if your wife is about to give birth. So even if your wife was about to give birth to your firstborn child and you received an order, you had to go execute on it. The second omerta, that's the rule of silence. To always be silent about the existence of Cosa Nostra. To be able to maintain silence even in the face of pressure from law enforcement or whatever. Yeah.
See, my comment on that one was that my teacher of Japanese history once commented that the rules of Bushido, which are so ingrained in modern American conceptions of Japan, were essentially an ideal that was followed far more in the breach than in actuality. In other words, it was a cultural ideal that you were also supposed to be loyal to your master, commit suicide if you did the slightest infraction, etc. But the reality was completely different. The reality was the samurai routinely betrayed their masters. It was common for daimyos to be assassinated by their underlings. Very common for people to surrender in the face of, you know, instead of committing suicide. And so while there was this cultural ideal that was held up and, you know, shining, you know, sitting there, this is the Bushido goal, the reality was it wasn't practiced. And so my feeling, without evidence, is that the mafia ideal is a similar sort of thing. In other words, they say, this is how you're supposed to behave, you're supposed to treat the family, you have your own reality. But the reality is, this is a criminal organization, and they don't talk about it. So how could anyone know if anyone ever lived up to the ideal?
Well, they could know if they violated Omerita, because they would know whether or not there were people who testified about the mafia.
That's
like, yeah, there eventually were, but it was pretty thin, right?
So you say that's your feeling without any evidence. I would say
not exactly no evidence, but go on.
Okay. The evidence really does support the fact that this is a very serious rule and people really did follow it in the time period in which I'm speaking. Again, that's 1900-1950. So scholars maintain some very serious debate over whether the mafia existed for almost 70 years. No one even knew if it was a real thing until several people came forward. Now, after the period of which I'm speaking, there's a flood of what are named penitents, which confirm the existence of the mafia, and that's how we know about it today. But whether people really followed this rule is evidenced by the fact that we didn't even know it existed at all for almost 70 years.
But that's not an accurate statement. It had been thought that the mafia existed, and in fact, there's historical documents that show the United States government negotiated with the American mafia during the Second World War to reduce labor unrest in the ports of New York. So we knew that there was a mafia, and there had certainly been plenty of popular fiction. So the fact that the scholarly community was divided as to whether there was real mafia is a very different thing from saying whether or not people knew that the mafia existed. We knew it existed. It wasn't any debate. When there were gangland hits and Chicago was taken over by the Italian mafia, that was a fact.
No, it's not a fact. That's somebody's interpretation of the evidence.
Right.
And you don't know a priori whether it really means that there is an organization or whether it just means that there are a bunch of criminals who are feuding with each other, people get killed, and a newspaper man thinks it makes a good story to call, say, it's the mafia. The flip side of this is an argument which I got from my uncle, who was a law professor at Chicago, which was that if you looked at the testimony about organized crime in the U.S., it divided neatly into two categories. One was the ceremonial stuff, which implied a sort of national organization. The other was the actual description of how they did business, which was a whole bunch of independent, very small businesses running various illegal enterprises. And that his conclusion, therefore, was there really wasn't organized crime in any serious economic sense because there wasn't anybody who was giving orders to these people. They weren't setting the prices for, you know, prostitutes or gamblers or something.
That's very far cry from saying whether the mafia exists because, as he says, the mafia was down to 47 individual families in the city of Palermo alone.
Of course, but the public picture of organized crime in the U.S., one of the reasons I asked him initially about the boss, is the General Motors of crime. And that, at least this evidence suggests, is a fiction. So I don't think you can go from the fact that... So his point is, if they hadn't been keeping their mouths shut, there would have been enough evidence to establish from a scholarly standpoint what was going on, as opposed to, well, people say there's a mafia, and, you know, it makes a good story, and I suppose I believe it, and so forth. But anyway, we're running out of time.
I just want to just kind of wrap things up,
yes.
Actually. Even over on the fourth question, I just got, like, two or three more points. I want to note that there were some very specific rules also that kind of governed your activity in particular situations. And there were hundreds of these. I would say that a mafioso's life was a study of these rules. learning how to follow them. And a person who followed them well was an honorable man. For instance, when you greeted someone, the word you used to greet him was very important. The right word meant you were respecting him. The wrong word meant you were either more powerful than him or you were showing an affront. You were in some way disrespecting him. And these rules were just all over the place. How you behave towards wives, how you behave towards bosses, what rackets were permissible, what rackets were impermissible. A lot of those. You know, I just want to open up the floor to questions.
Do you think that collection of rules is any more elaborate or difficult to understand than the ones that you follow? You have opinions about what behavior is permissible or impermissible, about how you treat people.